Of comparative religion class, which is called Christian Denominations. First semester is World Religions and Catholicism. Second semester is Christian Denominations. So we'll be talking about a number of Christian, this is the word Christian as used by individuals to discuss those who are supposed to be the followers of Christ. They aren't necessarily biblical followers of Christ. I want to comment too that it is my intent not to run down any particular organization. It is not my intent to make fun of them. There are times when what they do seems so outrageous that I do speak out against that. And I cite as my example Elijah. When Elijah was taunting the priests of Baal, saying, maybe you need to call a little louder. Maybe your God is sleeping. I use that as an example of why sometimes my human nature gets the best of me. However, my main attempt is to present that religion to you and let the Bible show where they are inaccurate. That's my intent. You have doctrines class, by which you're getting all types of information on basic doctrines of the church. It's not my intent to thoroughly discuss any particular doctrine, but to point out what they teach as doctrine and to show whether what they teach is corroborated by the Bible or validated, or is it invalidate that particular teaching. So that's my goal. You're given several handouts, by the way, quite a few. And I will share those with you right now. For those online or listening in, I'm giving a course outline. You'll notice the course outline, in which case the aim of this class is to survey most of the major religions as well as some of the modern ones, if I get a chance to bring some of the modern ones. We will give some background, facts, structure, overview of each denomination. We will also point out some of the unique characteristics and major doctrines of each, or some doctrines, unique doctrines of each religion, and show how that religion compares to the Bible. And then you'll notice the required book is World Religion in Brief, and Doug Rummel from the Columbus Church now was a teaching assistant with me when we put together this. And this is what I used to use as my standard text for the class that I had taught at Ambassador. It has been worked on to revise it to some extent, but we have not revised it yet and is no longer in print. But it's entitled World Religions in Brief, and it has about 5,000 copies out in circulation at this point in time, used primarily just for students at Ambassador. People came to the feast and bought it. You have got some of it here. John. That's this one.
Well,
that is the book. It's not available. No. He and I both jointly wrote it. I was the force behind it. And he helped me by adding, so each one of us did a religion, summarize it. We try to do it from their literature, mostly from the literature from that particular denomination or church, or what other fair-minded religions said about them, not weird religions.
Is it possible to obtain a copy?
You're getting some of it in these. I would rather not. I only have about 6 copies left, and I would rather not recopy the whole thing. I've copied as much of it as you need, and so therefore when you see assignments 61 to 63, that correlates with Greek Orthodox, and then the next one, and so on down the line, Episcopalians, 65 to 67, and so on. That's in here. Now, you don't have, it's your choice whether you read it or not. It would be helpful to you to read it over. It just give you an overall summary of the religion, because most of the religion, in spite of those who don't like PowerPoint, is going to be on PowerPoint. Most of them, second semester, will be on PowerPoint. If you don't want to read the PowerPoint, turn it over, okay, and take notes. And then at the end, be surprised at whether your notes fit, whether you got everything down. So I give you this. If you don't want to use this, some said they didn't like this and that, don't use it. Okay? Pay better attention. Just turn it over. Be disciplined enough to put it in the back and take your notes on it. That helps you better. Please do that. But anyway, this is what correlates with the assignments on the back. You've got this handout on secularism. I'll be covering that. And Eastern Orthodoxy, she handed this out too. We'll be doing this next time. So Eastern Orthodoxy will be next time. But today, since it's a two-hour class, I had originally scheduled secularism for the second class after this. So I'll be doing secularism the second half of today because it won't take me all morning to do the or all afternoon to do the introduction to this class. These are the what am I's. These are the what am I's for the entire year, second semester. You have them all in there, and we'll be doing most of them. We might not do a few. And some of them I may, if we rush for time, I may just do them on the screen. Others of them, you're going to have probably 10 opportunities to get together as a group. And a number of you commented that you really liked that because it gave you a chance to defend your faith. I want you to do that. Typical classes that I have taught, they did these. They had to turn these in at the end of the, when we finished the religion. They had to turn these in as papers, and then we would discuss them. But they had to do them themselves. Each person filled them out, turned them in, and they got 5 points or 6 points credit if they did them all. So they would do scriptures and talk about what how they believed in this, for instance, on Greek Orthodox, the filioque clause, the Holy Spirit only given by the Father. Is this true or not true? Well, we would agree the Holy Spirit comes from the Father, but over here it says Father through the Son, the scripture. So it appears that both Catholics and the Greek Orthodox are off in the sense that God the Father gives it through the Son. And so you explain however you do it. Transubstantiation, we talked about that before. Was it really Christ's body? Was it really Christ's blood that he gave away? Or did that stay with him? Did he only give bread and wine? And heavily emphasize the Trinity and so on. But you use scriptures to back it up. Is the Trinity a teaching of the Bible? Is the Trinity a teaching of paganism that's been added to make the Bible more the teachings of Christianity more palatable to those pagans who would come into the church? So anyway, that's what this is about. You hang on to these. You use them. You can write them down. They're for you to note, and especially in your groups. And when the other groups present, you can fill that in, and then you have a nice summary of some of the basic beliefs. John? Masonry?
Yeah.
No. No, Masonry is not a religion. But, I mean, Masonry basically is based on some of the Solomon's Temple and some of the secret rites. The quickest way to shoot down Masonry is that they take vows and that it's a secret society, and it's one that they show favoritism to those who are Masons. So if you're a Mason and you know the secret handshake, and I don't know it, but they do something with their fingers when they shake. And anyway, the secret handshake, when they do the secret handshake, then the guy's supposed to give you a favor. Okay, so you've got the what am I's, you've got the reading material, you've got secularism, which we'll cover toward the end of the class, and you've got your class information on what to expect throughout the semester. If there's anything I can, plus you've got Eastern Orthodoxy. So if there's anything I can do to help you, anybody else, did we give anything else out that I didn't mention? So you're loaded up. I give you all your ammunition. Now you've got your notebooks ready to go for the class. Okay. If you wanted to do an extra credit, and I'm not saying to do it, but if you wanted to do something extra, you've always interested in knowing how the Greek Orthodox Church is run. If three or four of you got together and went to the Greek Orthodox Church and just sat there on a Sunday and endured the service and then came back and wanted to do a report, I'd be happy to have you give a quick report. So I'll leave it up to you. I do not recommend you go to any Pentecostal church if you're inclined. Do not go to a Pentecostal church. Okay. Other than that, I don't see any huge problem any more than going to a Jewish synagogue. Jewish synagogue rejects Christ, remember? And if you went there, you've stepped out of line. I'm teasing you. I know Dr. Levy took you guys for Purim.
Why wouldn't you like
Pentecostals? Yeah. Because I believe there's extra spirits there. Obvious extra spirit that I would not want to see you subjected to. Jacob.
Hello to everybody in tape world.
Is he on?
No, my family and I, we were used to be Pentecostal up until my dad got the truth. My 1989, so, I mean, I was only five, but so I didn't really know anything, but I thought that'd be interesting. I remember, a couple years ago, we don't really go for service, we go for, like, a Wednesday night thing, like, if there's somebody there that's visiting from our family, we just go and visit, and that's it. Like, we don't take part of anything. But we haven't been recently. It's been years back. But I remember going once, and there's this visiting pastor, and he comes on stage, and he asks people to come up, and if they want to speak in tongues. And so the people come up, and, you know, they're jabbering on like crazy. I mean, and then he's sitting there like this. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I can't understand. I don't even know how he can understand what a word they're saying. That's just my story.
Okay, thank you. See, in 1 Corinthians 14, it talks about that when you speak in tongues, you should always have an interpreter. But what they have found is most of the people who interpret in King James English. Now, why in our modern day are you interpreting in King James English? And when we come to that religion, which is the last one we study, I used to have in the library, which I don't think we have anymore, there used to be an actual CD or whatever of somebody actually speaking in tongues. And if you played it, it would just sound like somebody is in a trance or is mesmerized or whatever. But they took a study they asked tongue speakers to give their very best tongues speaking, okay, message. So they took that, and they took one of those messages, and they got people that were reported to be the best interpreters that their church could put forth. They played this message, same message, to different interpreters. These people said they know how to interpret tongues. And they found that not one of the interpretations matched the same message. They also found that many of them speak, and I've asked quite a few who've been former Pentecostals, that what is spoken, what is interpreted, is in King James. Thou goest to the store and seeth the street or whatever. You know, it's done in King James language to make it sound more, because after all, you know, if King James language is good enough for the apostles, it's good enough for me. And that's how people think. You know, Ten Commandments, you know, Moses, before King James was ever around, God is speaking King James language. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Okay, why is he doing this? Because King James language, the King James Bible, has been spread throughout, and that 1611 language seems to be the language of Christianity, or the language of the Bible. So we'll come to that next time. All right, take a brief quiz. I'm not going to ask you to turn it in, but let's see how much you know about religion already. What religion finds more people than even the FBI? If you have a missing person, what religion finds more people than even the FBI? You can write it down to think about if you want to write just a note. Number two, what two churches were started by women? What two Christian churches were started by women? Number three, what religion, what Christian denomination believes that you will live forever on the earth in the flesh during the millennium? What religion believes that you will live forever on the earth in the flesh? Number four, what religion believes your marriage can be for time and eternity? Time and eternity. Number five, this religion has more blacks in it than any other religion in the United States. What religion has more of the black race than any other religion in the USA? Number six, what religion is called the Bridge Church or the Halfway House? The Bridge Church or the Halfway House? Number 7, what is the largest Protestant denomination in the USA? The largest Protestant denomination in the USA. And number 8, what nation has the highest percentage of total population of professing Christians? What nation has the highest percentage of total population professing Christians? Okay, let's go back and see how you did. Question number 1, what is the best missing persons bureau? Who knows?
Mormons.
Nope, Mormons. Nope. Salvation Army. Salvation Army finds more missing persons than the Federal Bureau of Investigation, than the police departments do, because when people run away and they need a place to stay, and what Salvation Army does, they will not tell the parents. They will try to talk to the person, say, if you let your parents know you're safe or whatever, we will not tell them where you are, but would you please let us at least call them and tell them that their child is safe? Okay, especially if the person's above age. So they find more, they have a better record of finding missing persons than the police departments do. Number 2, what 2 churches were started by women? Seventh Day Adventists is one. Quakers, no. Nope. Christian Science and Seventh Day Adventists. Christian Science and Seventh Day Adventists, the only 2 churches started by women. Number 3, what church believes that you can live forever in the flesh on earth during the millennium? What is it? No. Jehovah's Witnesses. Jehovah's Witnesses believe that you can, and I have the book on it, live forever on earth, and you will live forever. They believe that only the 144,000 will actually be changed from physical to spirit, but that the rest of them will remain as live forever in the flesh on earth. This one girl said, I can't wait. I have this wonderful boyfriend. I can't wait to live forever in flesh on earth. And she was just a young girl being taken away by the Jehovah's Witnesses' teachings. All right, number 4. What religion believes in marriage for time and eternity? Mormons. Time and eternity. You can get married and you seal your family under you. That's why you have such big families. They'll be kind of like their miniature kingdom under them in the kingdom. I'm sorry? Okay, number 5. There are more blacks. What religion has more blacks than any other? Baptists. Baptists. What religion is called the halfway house or the bridge church? Stretching? Okay, put your hands up. Yes, you got it. Did you look?
No.
Good, got it. Episcopalians or Anglicans are called the bridge church because they are Catholic in outlook or appearance and ceremony and ritual, but they are Protestant in their preaching. Protestant in preaching, Catholic in their rituals and their looks. Number 7, the largest Protestant church in the USA. Presbyterians? Baptists. I didn't tell you you could use a second. You could use it twice. Baptists. And what nation has the highest percentage of total population of Christians or believers in God? 98% USA.
What?
USA. USA. According to the stat that I read.
How old?
I'm sorry? Not too long ago, 98% profess a belief in God. They may not all be Christian, okay? May not all be Christian, profess a belief in God. It's the highest percentage of all. It's amazing. I know. You'd think Italians and all the rest. Italy, you see Irish. No, USA. Okay, more. There a few other stats. There are more poor people believe they will go to heaven than rich people. So if you're a poor person, you have a lot more to look forward to in going to heaven than rich people who don't really care as much. Only 40%, here's a stat, while 98% believe in God in the USA, 70% profess to belong to a religion. So you've got some 20 to 28% who believe in God, don't go to any religion, don't say they belong to any particular church. But 70% do. And then the numbers who go to church regularly, 40%. So any way you slice it, they're either close to 60% who don't go to church regularly or don't belong to a religion, 30%. So it's amazing how many people are out there who want to believe in religion. I was just listening to the radio this morning. They were talking about a woman who used to be a harlot who has become a preacher for Jesus Christ. You may have heard. You know what she does? She goes to a brothel or to a strip bar, and she pays one of the girls to sit down and talk to her. She pays her. And she talks to her about Jesus Christ. And she said many of those young girls break into tears and bawl over what they're doing. Because a lot of them are doing it to survive. But that's her way. And they're amazed that she would pay money to talk to them about Jesus Christ and what Christ did for them and so on. Now, I commend and I applaud the approach because this woman was a former prostitute who's changed. And so she wants to help bring these girls out of that. I thought it was an interesting approach. But only 40% go to church regularly, while 70% profess to belong to a religion, and while nearly 98% profess to believe in God. U.S. Catholics are very much like Protestants. We already mentioned that. If someone, and again, a lot of people believe in being born again, and you want to make sure you clarify what you mean about being born again. Somebody says, are you born again? I'd say, what do you mean? You mean, do I believe I have the Spirit of God? Yes. Because if you just say, I'm not born again, then they think you're not converted. Born again usually are the evangelical types that would want to see if you think you have the Spirit. And you want to say, yes. What do you mean by that? If you mean, do I have the Spirit? Yes. If you mean, have I changed from physical to spiritual? No. Okay, why do people go to church? Here's several answers that were given. Why do people go to church? Social status. They go to church so they can socialize with people. Well, that's a nice place to go. I like the Sunday school. I like the program that they have here. Social status. Number two, teachings. These aren't necessarily in the order of importance. Number two, teachings. They go there because they like the teachings. You know, the persons they teach, nice message. Three, parental pressure. Sometimes they go to church because my mother said, if you don't get to church, I'm going to be right on your doorstep knocking on it for you to let me in. Let me in so I could take you to church. So parental pressure. Another one is guilt. Why do people go to church? Guilt. I should be there. I better go. Number five, because of fear. Because of fear. I'm afraid somebody's going to get me. God's going to get me if I don't. Another one goes to church because of entertainment. Yeah, I like the music. Oh, the music's so beautiful. And music is beautiful. Music, because it carries with it an emotion, feelings, singing. Music can move you. You can move people with a message. So that's good, but if it's all just music, then I think it's lacking. So he talks about people go for entertainment. Some people go for the parking lot. Boy, it's real easy to get into that parking lot. I really like that. You don't have to worry about looking for a place to park. I like the parking lot. That's a good way to reason to choose a church. I like the minister. the minister's really nice. Well, nice people can do bad things. Okay? Just because they're nice does not mean that they're doing good or preaching good. Because my friends go there. My friend said, why don't you come? So I go because of my friends. Now, one thing I think we as a church can do a lot better is to make it nicer for people to come where they want to come because they see you. People do come because of relationships. That's an inducement to come. And if you come to church and you're rebuffed and repelled and isolated and nobody looks at you, nobody talks to you week after week, nobody even notices you, nobody even knows that you are around, you pretty soon, you'll have to be really dedicated to the teachings to keep on coming. So while it's not the first order of business, I go there because I like the people. If the people are nice, welcoming, and enthusiastic for you and make you feel welcome and receive you, then their likelihood of staying is much greater. Another reason why people go to church is because it's close. Distance. Especially with gas mileage now, the closer you can have a church, the better off. The gas, not gas mileage, gas prices. Closest. The proximity of that church makes them want to go. And the time of the service. I like going to that church because it's a morning church. Oh, I'm going to go there. I like going to church because it's the afternoon. I like going to church because they meet at 8 o'clock in the morning. I can go golfing right afterwards, you know, as long as the minister doesn't speak too long. You hear the name, the term, go to the church of your choice. Do you know why that saying is so good for the world? Do you know why it's out there? Because if you choose it based on just your feelings and your thoughts alone, you'll always choose the wrong one. Think of what we have to offer as a church. What do we offer? People come to our church, they keep the Sabbath. People come to our church, they've got a tithe. And first tithe and save a second tithe. And give to the emergency fund. People who come to our church, they've got to take off days throughout the year. Holidays, holy days, not holidays. People at our church don't keep Christmas and Easter. People at our church do lots of things. Go to the Feast of Tabernacles, usually is their main vacation time, where most people take their vacation in the summer, we take ours in the fall. People who come to our church are asked to follow the Ten Commandments, asked to walk with God and obey God. Already I have put before you a lot of things that human nature absolutely rejects. Some say Herbert Armstrong went out to build himself a church. I will say this. If Herbert Armstrong went out to build himself a church, he sure chose the wrong things. If you want to attract people, you don't have them doing all those things that put them in conflict with the world. You just don't. And yet God saw fit to bless along the way because it is the truth. You search the scriptures daily. So Satan knows if you just go because you chose it without using the scriptures, without using the word of God as truth to find it, he knows you always choose the wrong one. And what kind of church would you choose? There's a religion out there for everybody. You want to be active? You're an active sort of person? Join the Jehovah's Witnesses. Everybody's a minister. You want a church where everybody is noticed? You can go to the Mormons. Age 12, you're a deacon already. You want to have lots of different ranks that you can use? Join them. You want to go to a church where virtually nothing is required of you? Because nothing's really here except your mind. You're into mind. Christian Science. Mind Science. You want to go to a church that keeps the Sabbath, but doesn't believe that God's going to set up his kingdom on the earth, but it's going to obliterate everybody on the earth, take rapture God's people off. That's Seventh-day Adventists. So he has a religion for everybody. If you want one that reminds you of a religion, that looks like a religion, that feels like a religion, Catholics, Greek Orthodox, that looks like a religion. Well, you've got stained glass windows. You've got pews. You've got beautiful ornate surroundings. You've got lots of trappings. You've got lots of ceremony and ritual, candles lit and all the rest, incense. Hey, you could go there. If you want to go to a church that spun off from them, the one that challenged them first, you go to Lutherans. Satan, the devil, knows that if you choose the church of your choice, purely your choice, no Bible involved, you'll choose the wrong one. If you want a feel-good religion, you could go to the Pentecostals, deal into the feelings. All types of religions out there to fit pretty much every type of personality. You want it strict? You want something that where you deny yourself? Join the Amish or Mennonites. And you can feel like you deny yourself. You want a service where you sit there and do nothing but sleep? You want to go to a church and sit there and do nothing? Quakers. Unprogrammed service. I lie not. Our students went. You go there and you sit. And when service begins, they sit there for an hour. Nobody says a word unless someone has something that they feel moved by the Spirit to say. And they may stand up and say, "My dear Aunt Bessie is having a problem battling alcohol. I'm asking everybody to please pray for her." Sit down. Another person might stand up and say, "I'm having a real difficulty working on overcoming smoking, and I'm just asking everybody for their prayers." Otherwise, it's silence through the whole service. Unprogrammed service, because they believe that there's an inner light in you that you have to let that inner light come out. And so all you're doing is sitting there waiting for that light to want to come out. And if it doesn't come out, it doesn't come out. So all you're doing is sitting there waiting. There's always a church. You wouldn't choose God's church because God's the one that calls us. John 6 and verse 44. John 6 and verse 44. What God requires of you when he calls you is a whole lot more than the carnal mind could possibly take by itself. John 6:44, Jesus Christ said this, "No one can come and be a Christian," I'm paraphrasing it, "no man can come to me," no one can come to be a follower of Christ, "except the Father which has sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day." God the Father has to do the drawing. God the Father has to be the one that calls us. Romans 8 and verse 7, "It opens our minds so that we might see the beautiful truths that are contained in his word." But Romans 8, 7, you hit people with what's out there in the world, what's out with God's way to a worldly mind. Notice Romans 8, verse 7, "Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be." The carnal mind does not want the way of God. So your mind, if you're finding yourself being willing to yield to the way of God, you're finding that the Spirit of God dwelling in you is actually leading you to see and accept and want to follow his truth. If you are resisting it, it's that carnal mind that's coming up again and welling up inside of us all. Carnal mind is enmity against God. So why can't people choose the right way? Because they can't see it. And most people do go to church, 70%, but they don't believe they are the church. Most people go to church, they don't believe they are the church. The difference about God's church is we are supposed to practice Christianity every day, not just once we are at church. We don't just go to church to pray, although praying at church is certainly not wrong, but we pray every day. We don't just go to church so that we can be at church. We realize we are the church, because what is the church? Remember 1 Corinthians 16:19, the church that met in Priscilla's house, what did she have? A rather large mansion in which was this chapel? 1 Corinthians 16:19. "The churches of Asia salute you. Aquila and Priscilla salute you much in the Lord with the church that is in their house." So they had a church in their house. We have a church in the ABC lecture hall. We have churches in bars. I mean, not at that time. VFW halls and Odd Fellows groups. We have churches that meet at Unitarian churches. We have churches that meet in gymnasiums. We have churches that meet in cafeterias. We have churches that meet in schools. We have churches that meet in various legion halls. We have churches that meet all over. The church are the people. You are the church. 1 Corinthians 12. 1 Corinthians 12. You are the church. Many do not grasp that concept. They believe they go to church, but actually the church goes to the hall. The church goes to a hall. You don't go to church. If you go to church, you go to be with the people. 1 Corinthians 12, 12. For as the body, and remember, what is the body? Ephesians 1, 22 and 23 says the body of Christ is the church. For as the body is one, has many members, and all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit are we all baptized, joined into, immersed into one body, whether we be Jews or Gentiles, whether we be bond or free, and have been all made to drink of one Spirit. And again, Ephesians 1, 22 and 23 shows you that the body of Christ is the church. So when you're baptized, you receive the Spirit of God. God makes you a part of the body, which is His church. So what is the church? It's the collection of God's people. It's God's people. And you're the church. When you come together, the church meets in a hall. And when the church is meeting in that hall, that's the church. And that room at that time is where the church is. When the church leaves here, this is not the church anymore. This is the ABC lecture hall. When it's a gymnasium, after that time, we might tear it out of the chairs and have a basketball game. But before that time, when services are going on, this is the church. Why? Because that's where God's people are. And where they are assembling. We mentioned what happened to you, to the church rather, in the age of shadows, what happened according to Hurlbut, where he said that the church of the original apostles of those days practiced certain things. And after the close of the book of Acts, where we don't read any more of what happened to Paul, we read nothing about what happened to some of his immediate followers like Silas and Timothy and Titus. What happened to the church after that time? So then all of a sudden, when it comes back into clear view again, he says we find a church that's very different from that of the apostles. Well, we believe that the church ought to be like that of the apostles. Not different from. Now, does it use modern technology? Of course. So we don't ride around in horse and buggy. We don't walk. We don't not use telephones because they didn't have telephones. We don't not use broadcasting or microphones because they didn't have microphones. But we try to practice the same beliefs, the same faith, the same doctrines that they had back in those days. Something happened to the church. So, do you believe you found the church? Do you believe you know where God's church is? I just want to quickly talk to you briefly, scripturally, about what you can do to find the church. First of all, if I'm looking for the church, I'm going to look for a name. What's the name of that church supposed to be? Does God tell us anywhere in here what the name is supposed to be? Yes, He does. You can look at beginning of several of the books, but over in Corinthians particularly, I think four times in 1 Corinthians, he talks about the name of the church being the church of God. So 1 Corinthians 1, 2, he says, to the church of God, which is at Corinth, to the church of God, he writes to. And also, you can find over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 1 Corinthians 10, and verse 32, he says, give no offense, neither to the Jews, nor to the Gentiles, nor to the church of God. Then you find 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 16, he says, and if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. So there are three places right there. And other places throughout, you can look up Church of God and find, I think there are 11 or 12 places, Churches of God, Church of God, the Church of God, the pillar and ground of truth, that's in Timothy. Calls it the Church of God. So when I look in the Scriptures, I say, I'm going to find a name, Church of God. Can I call this water vodka? Yeah, I could call this water vodka, but is it? So I could say, this is vodka. It's water. Holding up, for those not seeing me, I'm holding up a bottle of Sobe green tea that has water in it now. So I could say, vodka. You could say, oh, it is. Looks like it. It's clear. So you could say, how do I find out? Well, let's analyze it. Does it have the characteristics? Anybody can call anything by any name. It doesn't make it that. If I call a door a window, does that make it a window? No. I say, there's a door over there. You say, it's not a door. I mean, a window. That's not a window. That's a door. No, I call it a window. Well, how can you prove it's not a window? You look up, what are the characteristics? So I don't just go by the name. The name is only an indication, but I believe if it is God's church, it will bear the name Church of God. Whatever adjectives it uses beyond that to describe it, whether it calls itself the Radio Church of God, the Intergalactic Church of God, the Catholic Church of God, the Protestant Church of God, the Church of God in love, the Church of God in greatness, the Church of God in simplicity. You could add all types of things to it, but I believe it must have that name. I believe that, okay, because that's what the Scripture says. Now, can it call itself the Church of God and not be the Church of God? Yes. How would I determine that? By characteristics. Then I go to the next level. What is the next level? God says they will be commandment keepers. Revelation 14 and verse 12. Revelation 14 and verse 12. Here we find at the end time, Jesus Christ in this book on Revelation, which talks about what's going to happen around the day of the Lord. What does he say? Here's the patience of the saints. And you can go back and find out what a saint is. 2 Corinthians 1 talks about a saint being a Christian. Here's the patience of the saints. What are those people doing? Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. So wherever that church is, they are going to be keeping the commandments of God, and they're going to be exhibiting the faith of Jesus Christ. Having faith. Having the faith of Christ. Revelation 12:17. Going back there, talking about the woman that blends into the, goes from physical Israel to the church. Notice Revelation 12:17. The dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now this, another descriptor, is that it carries on the teachings of Christ, the testimony of Christ. It preaches what Christ preached, as well as it keeps the commandments of God. Philippians 2:12 talks about a characteristic of the church, and we have no doubt that the church at Philippi was God's church. But notice what Paul says about them. Here's a hallmark of God's people. Wherefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, obedience to God, obedience to rules, obedience to commandments. Wherefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. So a second layer you go to. You have a name. There could be lots of people that call themselves Church of God. There are many churches of God. But now how do you define them? Well, they must be keeping the commandments, one of which is what? The fourth one. You shall keep the Sabbath day holy. So I'd knock out a lot of churches of God. A lot of Pentecostals call themselves churches of God. Knock out a lot of them who don't keep the Sabbath. That's out. Why? Because God says they're going to be commandment keepers. They're not commandment keepers. They're missing the Sabbath. Lock that one out. Okay? So, got to be commandment keepers. Got to have the name Church of God. And then you talk about the commission. What is their role? What is their job? What are they trying to do? Are they just pie in the sky? Well, we want to reach the whole world with 10 people. A little hard to do. Now, again, if they're building up, that's a different matter. But Matthew chapter 28, verses 8, 19, and 20, Jesus Christ gave a commission to his disciples to go out and reach the world. Preach this gospel. And are they giving it freely, or do they sell it? Is there a hook? When I came to the church, I said, I know there's a hook. My brother left for Ambassador College. My parents were very disappointed, but my dad kept his word. He said, if they give Herbert Armstrong a clean bill of health in Pasadena, I'll let you go. He was sure that Herbert Armstrong would be labeled as a charlatan, as a fraud. And so he wrote to, had my brother Dave write to the Chamber of Commerce in Pasadena and ask them, what do you have to say about Herbert Armstrong and Ambassador College and all this? And they gave him high marks. My dad was so disappointed. Thought for sure they would say, this guy's a fraud. He's just bilking people of their money. He's doing this. And my brother wanted to go, and my dad didn't want him to go. When he got the letter back, my dad couldn't refuse because he already promised them. So my brother left, but my dad said to me, I don't want you ever to go to that church, ever. I don't want to hear you listening to the program, nothing. And then a few weeks later, I found my dad listening to the World Tomorrow program on his radio because he went to bed earlier than I did. So since he had it on, I turned it on in my room. He listened for a few weeks, and then he quit. But since he had already started listening, it allowed me to start listening. So I started listening, too, and started to get interested that way. But what I said was, you know, this guy probably is a fraud. He just wants you to, you know, he wants to get you to come. Then he'll say, send me your money. So I'm going to get all the literature, every booklet, every article, anything that is asked for, that is advertised, I'm going to ask for it. And I'm not going to send them a penny. And you watch, they'll send me a note and say, you got to give me some money or else it's going to not give you this anymore. Or we'll give this to you for a gift. Not once did I ever have that happen. And so while I was convinced of tithing, and I didn't make much money as a poor college student at that time, whatever I did make, I tithed, I set aside. But I wasn't going to give it to them. And I said, I'm going to see if they ever ask me for money. Not once was I ever asked for money. And I got all the literature I could have free because of other people who believed in what preaching the gospel was all about. So we give it. Matthew 10:8 says, freely you have received, freely give it. So the fact that I received it freely meant that I was willing to jump in and help give it freely as well. So I believe the commission, preaching the gospel, go to all the world, reach out to people, baptize those whom God calls, and doing it with God's force and God's power, opening the doors wherever and however possible. I believe also the fruits, the product of our church are the people. Product of our church are the people. Galatians 5:22 and 23 tells you the type of fruits that God's people bear. And you've been to different churches, haven't you? Do you find them the same? Different parts of the country? Oh, maybe personalities are somewhat different. But how do you find them as people? Do you find them the same? Cynthia?
Galatians 5:22 and 23.
They're the same. You go wherever you go, or to other countries. You go to the Philippines, or you go to Malta, or you go to Italy, or you go to Germany. You find the same spirit, God's people. Something's made a difference in their lives. Something's made a difference in their lives. And you see the fruit being produced. Matthew 7:20 says, by their fruits you shall know them. They are Bible-based. God's church is Bible-based. That doesn't mean you can do every single thing from the Bible because the Bible doesn't have modern technology in it. But it still tells you you should use modern technology honorably. No matter how modern the technology is, it should never be used in an ungodly way. So you have all these modern technologies. Should we use these microphones that can pick up? You could just point it at a window. Should we use that to eavesdrop on people? No, we should not. Well, you have computers. Should we use that to trowel out evil and rottenness? No, we should not. So because you have modern technology, it does not mean you should use it for evil means. You should always use whatever is available to you for godly means. So we are Bible-based. We try to look at the Bible for guidance and direction. We're growing in grace and knowledge. We're willing to admit our errors. When we make a mistake, we're willing to change. We're willing to say, hey, that was a mistake. We're not going that direction anymore. We're willing to change when we see that error. God's church has unity. Ephesians 4 talks about the unity. Unity. I'll tell you, when we go to the Methodist church, when the man from Southern Methodist came to teach us, you know what he said? I asked him a question. What kind of a Methodist are you? Are you Wesleyan Methodist? Are you just a, you know, United Methodist? What type of... He said, if you're asking, will you get the same answers from different Methodists? He said, if you ask six Methodist preachers the same question, you get seven different answers. And he thought that that kind of diversity, that kind of divisiveness or division was good. And so in our classes, here we were all taking classes because they sent a professor over to Ambassador University, and we would all get together on a Sunday from 8 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the evening with 1 hour break for lunch. We would have class with this professor. So he would ask a question, and he would expect a lively debate, and one of us would answer the answer, and they'd say, someone else said, yep, that's right. Yep, that's it. That's right. And he was shocked because he was expecting like six or seven different answers. But when we nailed it, he was surprised. You know what he said about that group? I have never met a group of men who have more integrity with the Scriptures. I've never met a group. Mr. Thompson was there. Dr. Ward was there. A number of us were there who were in the church here now too. But he said, I've never met a group of men who had such integrity with the Scriptures. And so they were shocked that we did. Another one came and said, well, you know, I've got to figure out how all these religions can be saved. Because God's losing the battle. If you try to say, if we look at the world and say, how many Christians are there, or godly folk, and how many are not Christians, and ungodly folk, the ungodly folk are winning. So we've got to figure out how some of these people that are not our God really are somehow backdoor. We can work them in, make them Christians so we could be winners. And we said, you know what? We don't worry about that because we believe God is only calling some now, that everybody will have a chance. Shot down his whole class. I mean, it was the beginning of his beginning lecture. Well, so what do you believe is going to happen to all these people? We believe there will be a second resurrection when all people will hear his voice and the trumpet sound and come forth out of their graves and have a chance in their own order, 1 Corinthians 15. We shot down the guy's whole class. I don't think he liked us after that. Another case, a guy was reading the Old Testament. He was telling us these stories like we had never heard them. He was a professor, doctor at his Southern Methodist University. So I raised my hand. I said, is this the way you teach the people in your classes? Because it seems to me like you're teaching me as if I've never heard of this person before in my life. He said, that's the way I teach over there. But he understood. We knew right away. We talk about Samson did this. We know about Samson. We read about Samson. Abraham did. We knew about Abraham. We talk about this person. We knew about. Why? Because we study our Bibles. Why? Because we are Bible-based as an organization. So there are a number of things that you can look at. And the unity that we have is awesome. And we believe that Jesus Christ is the founder, that no man is the head, and you should not look to any man as the head of the church, but to look to Jesus Christ as the head of the church. All right, I'll stop there, take a break. Come back at 22. He's known as the Church of God throughout all these centuries. People may have called him any number of things, just like people have called you and me Armstrongites or they call what we follow Armstrongism, just like people use those type of terminology toward a particular group. It does not mean that's what that church considered itself. I would believe any church of God, any church that was God's church, would always consider itself the Church of God. Whatever they add to that, whatever descriptors they add to that, it is a different matter. And also, I do believe that God's church is composed of every person who has God's Holy Spirit and walks with him. And we're not talking organizationally now. Jacob, do you want to talk in the microphone? Because one thing it was mentioned to me, if you have a question, please ask in the microphone. What was asked of me during the break was there are a lot of gaps in when people ask questions, and sometimes I'm in my enthusiasm to answer you, I don't always repeat the question. Therefore, it's kind of blank in there when people are, so in order to fill in, if you have a question, Jason, you has the microphone, so just raise your hand, and Jason, you go hand the microphone to them. But now, go ahead, Jacob.
Do we also refer to ourselves as first century Christians?
Yes. First century Christians. We refer to ourselves as a first century Christians in a 20th century setting. Yes. First century Christians. We follow what people did back then. Do you not think we should do that? Okay, yeah, that terminology has actually been used. Okay, that's enough on that. I want to go through secularism real quickly. Reason I put secularism here, last year I put it right at the end of the class. Some thought I should give it toward the beginning. I did not give it toward the beginning because Mr. Register came in and gave you 8 classes on something similar, but I think this will be a little bit different than his presentation, and I'd like to share it with you. So let's talk about secularism. You have your handout in front of you. So here you see a book actually talking about secularism, the greatest challenge facing Islam, because Islam sees secularists taking people away from any belief in God, not only a Christian belief in God, but an Islamic belief in God as well. Here you find from Susan Jacoby, The Free Thinkers, and I have this book and I've read a lot of it, The Free Thinkers, and it gives a history of American secularism. She even points out that some of our famous heroes like Thomas Paine, who wrote Common Sense and tried to help the American Revolution, also Ben Franklin and a few others, Thomas Jefferson and a few of the presidents, were actually secularists. And when the Constitution of the United States was being written, there were those who were the authors of it who actually wanted to include that this nation is founded under God, that this nation is founded by God. But the secularists managed to get God taken out of that part and just say, we the people do hereby establish, instead of we believe God has established this union. They say, we the people. So they had some influence in that area. Here you find Thomas Paine, who was very helpful, but Thomas Paine was also a rebel and later on showed that he was against God. I have a quote here about him. Let's see if I can pick it out for you real quickly. Where I put that. Yeah, here we go. Thomas Paine, the radical propagandist and voice of the common man. Thomas Paine was born in Tetford in Norfolk in January 29th, 1737. His father, Joseph, was a poor Quaker corset maker who tried to provide his son with an education at the local grammar school, but eventually was forced to apprentice him to his trade. Paine was unable to accept this occupation. Then he talks about later on, he was incarcerated in Luxembourg because of what he had tried to do. During his imprisonment, Paine embarked upon his third influential work, The Age of Reason, a deist manifesto to the core. Paine acknowledged his debt to Newton and declared that nature was the only form of divine revelation. For God had clearly established a uniform, immutable, and eternal order throughout creation. So therefore, he just looked to creation. Paine rejected Christianity, denied that the Bible was the revealed word of God, condemned many of the Old Testament stories as immoral, and claimed that the Gospels were marred by discrepancies. There was nothing really that new in Paine's argument, but the bitterness of his attack on Christian churches and his attempt to preach deism to masses made him more enemies than before. So he believed in God. There was a belief in God, but a God the way he would want him to be believed in. And he took a different course. But a lot of people liked him because when he wrote the book on Common Sense to try to help people gear up to fighting the British, That was then he was looked upon highly, but he actually was a secularist. Here's his two books, a Book of Common Sense on the left, and the one, The Age of Reason, on the right, that he wrote. In The Age of Reason, he declared that if he didn't, here's what he says in The Age of Reason. Paine declared that he did not believe in any religion, and that all religions are institutions established for the enslavement of mankind. So this is what his belief was. Paine went on to strongly criticize the Bible and document many fallacies in the Bible, as well as giving an excellent account of how the Christian religion developed from its pagan, early pagan roots, and analysis which still holds weight to this very day. Paine denied the truth of the story of Christ's birth and of his resurrection. That comes from rationalrevolution.net. So again, Thomas Paine, yes?
But he believed in God.
He believed in God, but his own version of God, a deist. Now, another person that was very popular among the secularists was Charles Braidlaw. Charles Braidlaw, and I think I have something on him here as well. See if I can find it real quickly. Maybe I think I had it in my other book. Yeah, here we go. It's an article on secularism from the Catholic Encyclopedia, because Catholics were also worried about the impact of secularism, which turns people against Christianity. It says, secularism, a term used for the first time in about 1846 by George Jacob Holyoake, to denote a form of opinion which concerns itself only with the question, with questions, the issues of which can be tested by experience in this life. So he would deny any revelation. More explicitly, secularism is that which seeks the development of the physical, moral, and intellectual nature, and I may quote this later on, of man to the highest point as the immediate duty of life, whatever develops man. Which inculcates its practical sufficiency of natural morality apart from atheism, theism, or the Bible, which selects as its methods of procedure the promotion of human improvement by material means and proposes these positive agreements as ennoble it by service. Secularism is a code of duty pertaining to this life. What you have to remember, it's all about this life and this world, founded on considerations purely human and intended mainly for those who find theology indefinite, inadequate, unreliable, or unbelievable. And it goes on to give us its essential principles, which we'll cover a little bit later. The origin of secularism is associated especially with names of Holyoake and Braidlaw. And it talks about both of them and what they had to do with it. Charles Braidlaw adding many of these things. Braidlaw says, I studied a little the 39 articles of the Church of England, the four Gospels, and came to the conclusion that they differed. And so then his views, which at times were deistical, later on reached extreme atheism. And in fact, they say to be a good secularist, you must ultimately become an atheist. So it's not doesn't just stop with, well, we believe in God, but we want to keep him out of the picture and we want to be able to rationalize. Here you see Robert Ingersoll was also called the great agnostic. Quote, he was the most masterful articulator of the secularist vision. Robert Ingersoll. The most masterful articulator of the secularist vision. One of the most important figures in the history of American secularist dissent. Now understand that what secularists want to do, they want to trouble you with your beliefs. Then they want to tell you there's a better way, their way. What secularism is, comes from the Catholic Encyclopedia. A code of duty pertaining to this life, I quoted part of this, on considerations purely human, intended mainly for those who find theology indefinite, inadequate, unreliable, or unbelievable. Secularism means, it's another quote, belonging to this world. Belonging to this world. A philosophy of life with rules of conduct having no necessary ties to religion. The term was first used in 1846 that meant one could be concerned with questions as they were tested by experiences in this life. Secularism seeks to advance its own form of morality. See, this is the point. They don't mean that you shouldn't have any morality. You should have their form of morality. It adds concern for culture, social progress, and improvement of material conditions of life, especially for working class people. Secular knowledge is founded in this life. They do not want it from revelation from God. They want it founded in this life. Charles Bradlaugh stated that the logical consequence of the acceptance of secularism must be that a man gets to atheism if he has brains enough to comprehend. He will get to atheism if he has brains enough to comprehend. So the ultimate end is to lead you to not believe in God at all, to trust in what you have. What does that do for your future? Secularism is that which seeks the development of physical, moral, and intellectual nature of man to the highest possible point as the immediate duty of life, which inculcates the practical sufficiency of natural morality. I read this already, apart from the Bible, atheism, and theism, which selects as its methods of procedure the promotion of human improvement by material means, who would regulate life by reason and ennoble it by service. So they still believe in doing service to people. You can make lots of money and give some money to charity. Make lots of money and help people. Regulate, but life is regulated by reason. If you can reason out something, that's what's required. What secularism is? Secularism is a protest against the doctrine of providence and God himself. It's a protest against God and the doctrine of providence, that someone up there has some control over you. The fundamental principle of secularism is that in his whole conduct, man should be guided exclusively by considerations derived from the present life itself. See, again, no future. Where's the future? In fact, they answer a lot of questions. He says, well, I hope that if there is a future, that God would be merciful to us if we've done wrong. I hope that if you've done wrong, if you've turned people against God, and now all of a sudden in the end, if we've done wrong, God's going to be merciful to us. The term secularism was chosen to express the extension of free thought to ethics. Again, the free thinkers. Is there anything wrong with free thinking? When do you want to be a free thinker? When do you want to be a free thinker? I can tell you. Hey, if we have a brainstorming group and we're saying, well, what do we want to do for socials? How about let's go kayaking? How about let's go to Kings Island? How about let's go to a Reds baseball game? That's free thinking. You're brainstorming. You're blue skying it, as they say. There's a time to do that. But not free thinking about, what's up? My opinion about God's way is just as good as God's word. I can do whatever I want. I don't have to listen to God's word. I don't have to follow what he says. I can do what I want. That's free thinking. Free thinking that leads you away from God is not good thinking. Various doctrines of secularism have been around for ages and stem from the free thinkers from the past. Secularism claims to be only an extension of free thought. So you get the connection to free thinking. Quotes about secularism. Secularism is a subtle cultural force, and the Christian is not immune from its corrupting influence. Secularism does not always cause one to abandon his religion immediately. More frequently, it creates a mindset in which life is mostly compartmentalized and religion is pushed from the center to the periphery. They don't want you to abandon your religion immediately. They just want you to discard it. They just want you to minimize it, push it to the side. Gain is godliness. get your mind off of this and get your mind onto that. That's what they want you to do. And eventually you will leave your church because the ultimate end, remember Charles Braidlaw? The ultimate end is to lead you to become an atheist. Secularism's three essential principles are, these are the three I was going to mention to you. One, the improvement of this life by material means. All we want you to do is have more things, bigger things, better things. That science is the available providence of God. You wonder where all these thoughts come from, where people talk about science, how science is the God. We're waiting for science to create this. I mean, I marvel at what science, true science, I marvel at. I marvel at new cancer cures. By the way, I dreamed last night I had cancer and I was going to die. I woke up this morning thinking, man, I went to the hospital person and said, your tests are back and you have cancer. And that you, that your tests are back and there's a spot in your abdominal region. And I said, so is it serious? They said, well, we don't know. The person who examined it just said that you should be ready for grief. So I woke up feeling pretty sad. Anyway, I hope I don't have cancer. Anyway, but anytime you read about things, science has discovered this. Hey, there's a cure for cancer. Hey, there's a cure for this. Hey, they're doing that. They could attach your, I mean, my wife has a bionic shoulder. You know, she's got a titanium shoulder because her shoulder was so bad with arthritis and everything that they actually replaced her shoulder with a, she has a ball and a joint that are titanium. And so she's doing great with that. I mean, she got a new shoulder, and I can't hit her in the arm anymore. I'll hurt my fist if I did. And I don't hit her anyway, but if I did, I'd hurt my fist, so I don't want to hit her in the arm anymore. So don't chuck her on the arm. You might break your fist. Yeah, she's got her shoulder is now a ball and socket and ball joint are titanium. Science is the available providence of man. They're going to save man. And notice the last one. This is a good one. That it is good to do good. It is good to do good. Whether there be other good or not, the good of the present life is good. And it is good to seek that good. So, it's good to do good. And whether there be other good or not, the good of the present life is good. And it's good to seek that good. So, seek the good of the present life. And maybe there's other good out there, but let's just focus on this. To the criticism of theology, secularism adds a great concern for culture, social progress, improvement of material conditions of life, especially for the working classes, since the existence of a future life, as well as the existence of God, belong to the debatable ground of speculation. Say, let's just do good now because we don't even know if there is a God. Only the atheist can be a consistent secularist. There's another statement. That comes from Catholic Encyclopedia. So, let's summarize. Before I summarize secularism for you, I want to read you a couple of quotes. These are astounding. Some basic ideas, the Enlightenment, humanism. Oh, yeah, here's one called the Secularist's Catechism. Secularist Catechism, you know what a catechism is. It's where you ask a question and you answer it. Teaching by question and answer. This book contains the motto, to believe without evidence and demonstration is an act of ignorance and folly. So you can't demonstrate God. You can't demonstrate the Bible is of God because you didn't see God write it. So if you want to have reason not to believe, you definitely could do it based on them. It's by Charles Watts, who's the vice president of the National Secularist Society. And here's what he wrote many years ago, by the way, is their foundation, their what is secularism? He says it means belonging to this world. And he talks about their statements and what they have adopted. Here's one. It says it is the extension of free thought by reason. It goes on to say, question, what is reason? We define reason as being man's highest intellectual powers. The understanding, the faculty of judgment, the power which discriminates, infers, deduces, and judges. The ability to premise future probabilities from past experience and to distinguish truth from error. Only on your based experiences in this life. What is truth? Their answer, that may be taken as true, which the best knowledge endorses, the largest intellects accept, and the widest experience vouches for. So if intellects don't like the Sabbath, throw it out. If intellects don't like telling the truth, throw it out. If intellects don't like not living with someone, throw it out. What intellects accept, what the best knowledge endorses, and what the widest experience vouches for. Amazing. What is experience? Experience represents knowledge acquired through study, investigation, and observation. What is secular morality? You'll like this one. We teach that morality consists in the performance of acts that will exalt and ennoble human character, and in avoiding conduct that is injurious either to the person or to society at large. Whatever you can get away with, whatever doesn't bother anybody, you can do. Whatever the society accepts, you can do. Question, from a secularist point of view, why should we speak the truth? Answer, well, because experience teaches us that lying and deceit tend to destroy that confidence between man and man, which has been found to be necessary to maintain the stability of mutual social intercourse. He goes on to talk about how are they superior to Christianity? How is secularism superior? In the fact that secularism affirms certain rights which are denied by Orthodox Christianity of the churches and in the New Testament. They talk about some of those rights. They have one section here I want to get to. Is it a necessity? Yes. Does it seek to destroy? Well, it's out to destroy the errors. What is their view of the Bible? Secularist affirms that the Bible is merely a human production. You believe humanists? That's what you'll believe. Secularist catechism, he talks about the end. Let's see if I can find this one spot. Talks about the end time. Let's see if I can find it real quickly. Talks about slavery and what they have done. Standard of truth. Yeah, future. Have secularists no fear of future punishment, supposing they are wrong? Answer, certainly not. For if there be a just God, now all of a sudden, if there be a just God before whom we are all to appear to be judged, he will never punish those whom he has not vouchsafed the faculty of seeing beyond the grave. So we know that just God won't punish us because of what we've done, because he's a just God. If there is a just God, we're protected there too. Whole section on it, if you're ever interested in reading it. It is a lot of gobbledygook. Let me share with you New Humanist Manifesto. 120 religious leaders, philosophers, scientists, writers, social scientists have signed a document criticizing religious dogmatism and stressing that humans alone must solve the problems that threaten the existence on earth. Quote, no deity will save us. We must save ourselves. Here's their manifesto. It promises of immortal salvation, of fear, or fear of eternal damnation are both illusory and harmful. They distract humans from the present concerns, from self-actualization, from rectifying social justices. Second, another comment. We affirm that moral values derive their source from human experience. Ethics is autonomous and situational, needing no ideological sanction. Ethics stem from human need and interest. To deny this distorts the whole basis of life. We strive for the good life here and now. And then, of course, they have a lot of differences here. Moral relativism, what applies now, standards and morality and positions of right or wrong are culturally based. See, if the culture accepts this, do it. That's what you're trained under. That's what you're taught under in school. That's what you come out of in this world. So let's summarize secularism real quickly. It is of the world. Its experience in this life is the best teacher. They follow their own morality. This life now is what matters. They eventually will deny God. Use of reason to determine life's goals. a protest against God. The need for religion is diminished. They look to material means for any resolution, problems, or advancement. Science replaces God. Do-gooders without goodness. What are the obvious difficulties with this new ism? You take the Bible. What do the scriptures say? And I'll stop here. We'll pick that up next time. We'll finish this part. Because I think this part is so important for us to recognize. Secularism is out there. Watch for it on your TV. Watch for it in the reasonings, particularly on the main channels, the CNN, the CBS, the NBC, the ABC, and you'll hear it. You just look for it. You'll hear all this laced throughout because it's throughout our media. It's throughout our educational systems. It's throughout our politicians and their presentations. Because that's what's important today is secularism. Taking our society away from God and taking them to what the world has to offer.